How's everybody doing? Good? Good Wednesday?
Yeah.
For those of you who haven't been in before, I'm John Noltner. I'm from Minnesota. This is my fifth year coming to Holden Village. Our first year was, we were chased out by the fire. We were evacuated and got to see the valley filled with smoke and feared that it wouldn't be Holden anymore. And then we got to be grateful when it was. So. I just want to take a minute and acknowledge some of the amazing conversations that I hear going on in the village this week, and some of the resonance I hear between the teaching staff. I think is everybody familiar with the notion of thin space? No, this idea, the distance between the physical world and the spiritual world, and when they get closer together. That's that thin space. And I think I've always thought of Holden as that. And I feel like it's particularly scrawny, thin space this week. Just a lot of really great, soulful conversations going on. So thanks for your part in that. And thanks for coming up tonight. So I'm going to start not on topic. I'm going to start with a small little aside. Does anybody know the history of the peace sign? Back there.
Yeah, it's I've heard it was an upside down broken cross in the past, sort of an anti-Christian symbol.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that before, that it's an upside down broken cross that is an anti-Christian symbol.
back in high school in a religious history class.
Oh, that's an interesting one. Anybody else? Do you have?
Semaphore sign for nuclear disarmament.
Boom. Yeah. Gerald Holtom was a British designer in 1958 during the British movement toward nuclear disarmament. Semaphores, using flags to direct things in on a ship, to communicate across distances when there's not radio signals. Nuclear disarmament, semaphore for N. is like this, flags out to either side. Semaphore for D, disarmament, is straight up and down. So you put those two together, you put a circle around them, and that is where the peace sign comes from. Gerald Holtom was interviewed later on in his life. He gave it away, he never copyrighted it or trademarked it. He wanted the world to have it. Later on in his life, he said it also reminded him of somebody in despair, disappointed with how we're not attaining peace with their arms out to the side and their head put back in a sign of frustration and despair. So as I travel around the country, actually if you look closely enough around Holden, you might find a couple of peace signs that I have built or scratched into the dirt or arranged out of pine cones. And I started doing that a number of years ago, and at first it seemed like a silly little project. But I started doing it in places that I came across that I felt needed healing, or places that needed some acknowledgement of an attempt to do better. This is the site where Emmett Till's body washed up in the Tallahatchie River in Mississippi after he was lynched back in the Civil Rights Movement. It was hard to find the place. There are some signs that were put up to honor the site, but those signs keep getting shot full of holes, and so they've taken them down. There was one sign that was still a couple miles away that had 13 holes in it when I passed, and I just saw a news article in the BBC that it's got more holes in it now. But we went here, found that spot, and built the peace sign as an acknowledgement of a place that needs healing, a recognition of our part in some of the wounds that have happened across the country, and a commitment to try to do better. So I do this exercise with children sometimes where I have them build these peace signs, and when I sit down with them, I tell them, first of all, there are some great parallels between building a peace sign and creating peace in the world. And the first is that you don't need any special tools. Everything you need is right in front of you. You know, everything you need is available to you right now for building a peace sign or for making peace in the world. It doesn't take long to build a peace sign. It doesn't take long to create a little peace in the world. odds are really good that when you do that, that someone's going to come around and disrupt it. That's not going to be permanent. But when that happens, you can come back and you can put it in place with a little bit of effort, and then it's there again. So that's just a little aside. Before we start our real conversation for today, and I want to preface it by saying that I've found myself pulled into conversations lately around the criminal justice system, around prison reform, around incarceration in any number of different ways, and I want to promise you that I'm not an expert. I have opinions, I've had some experiences that I think are worth exploring a little bit, but I'm not an expert, but this has been my way of exploring ideas. You know, I've got this weird platform of photography and storytelling that gives me some peculiar access into some places that I otherwise couldn't get, and allows me to meet some people that I otherwise couldn't meet. And that's particularly interesting for me, but it's particularly useful, I think, when I can share it with other people. And so some of this is pretty new to me. Some of this is not fully processed or fully formed in my mind, but I want to share it with you. I want to get some of your feedback and, you know, together maybe explore some ideas around this kind of thing. I came across some numbers from the Prison Policy Initiative. This is incarceration rates per 100,000 people. In the state of Louisiana, which is one of the highest numbers in our country, 1,052 people for every 100,000 people. That's a full 1% of the population. In the United States as a whole, 698 people per 100,000 that are in the prison system. Now look who we're keeping company with. Look who we're ahead of. Cuba, 510. Russia, 413. Iran, 284. Saudi Arabia, 197. UK, down to 141. China, 118. Norway, 74. Sweden, 57. 10% of what our country is, less than 10%. I'm curious what your thoughts are about that. What do those numbers say? What do they tell us? Yeah.
My comment would be those places where the numbers are very low do not have prisons. So how can you count incarcerations if they don't have prisons?
Oh.
They deal with it on their own. They don't incarcerate.
In Sweden and Norway?
I don't know. I'm just saying,
okay.
Do they have...
That's a thought. Do they have prisons in those places? Okay. All right. What else are we thinking when we see those numbers? Yeah, Mike.
As like one of the most developed countries in the world, why is our number so much higher?
Yeah, as one of the most developed countries in the world, why is our number so much higher? Yeah.
I have a question. Does the U.S. number include jails, not just prisons?
Yeah, I think that those numbers include people who are in the criminal justice system. So that would include jails and prisons.
And I'd suggest that the U.S. number is high in part because we've tried to solve drug and alcohol problems with incarceration.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. Can everyone hear people okay?
Yeah.
All right, feel free to raise a hand if you don't and we can repeat them. Yeah, back there.
We've also made prison a for-profit institution. People make money off of it.
Yeah, people have made money off of it. We can talk about this more later, but the three strikes and you're out policy, even small drug offenses that you're talking about, will put you in prison for a life sentence, and you do the math. And that was heavily lobbied by for-profit prisons who wanted to see that sort of get tough on crime thing. You do the math on what it costs per prisoner, per bed, per day, you extrapolate that to a large number of incarcerations, and that's a lot of money. Yeah. Yes?
We were in Scandinavia a year ago, and we learned some about that, and that the focus was, yes, people had to do the time, but the goal was to get them reintegrated back into the community. So the focus was, how do we, you know, yes, you did a crime, yes, you have to, you know, do X amount of time for it, but again, the most important thing is, how do we bring that back in? And I don't think we do any of that.
So that's a restorative process. That's a process of, how do we make people whole? How do we make the community whole, as opposed to a punitive process, which is just, you know.
Well, and lower recidivism then.
Who said lower recidivism? Yeah, lower recidivism. I think when you go to places like Norway and Sweden, I don't have stats on it, and I'm not really a numbers guy anyway, but I think it's pretty close to zero.
Yeah.
It's ridiculously low compared to ours. Cindy, did you have your hand up?
I think I was going to say kind of the same thing, but I think our goal was punishment and their goal was rehabilitation.
Right.
Yeah. And other thoughts, yes.
It's not just the individual that's punished, it's their immediate families. Their parents, their kids, the people that depend on them for support.
So think about how
it's a lot bigger than that.
Yeah, think about how that ripples out and how that makes those people vulnerable to future social problems. Yeah. Yes.
Well, also in the United States, our mental health system, our prisons become a place for people with mental illness more often than not, because we don't have proper...
It's the easiest place to warehouse them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In the corner.
Are we accommodating our prisoners too well with nice, cushy, repeat customers?
No.
Yeah. Are we accommodating?
You go to Mexico and you sleep on a pad, your family brings you food and water and bedding, those you don't get any.
Yeah, I don't know where it falls. I know it falls lower than the United States on the list. Yeah, Chuck.
I think the statistics are startling, but I think you have to factor in, and I'd wonder how U.S. was before we did away with mental institutions.
Well, we're gonna get into some numbers that look at where we used to be 30 years ago and where we are today, and we're gonna explore that a little bit. I don't know that that parses out precisely on mental health. I think there's a lot of other factors involved, but it is interesting to look at what our trajectory has been. Mm-hmm.
I can answer that in part, because if you look at the last 50 years, the rates of institutionalization and incarceration are mirror images.
Yeah, yeah.
As one's gone up, one's gone down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For mental health.
For mental health. Yeah. Yeah.
So as mental health care institutions have gone down, incarceration has gone up. So you're saying there's a pretty clear correlation.
In my mind, I've looked at the data and it looked pretty clear to me.
Yeah.
The China number is probably an older number because they've got over 1 million Uyghurs incarcerated at this point.
Yeah, I think that, which is a fairly new development. I think these stats are about 2 years old, which means the real information is probably a couple years older than that. Yeah, good point. Yes.
And I've just heard anecdotally, but I think some of those countries, they're kind of not through the criminal justice system, that they take care of people that aren't conforming, whether it's
dissidents,
vigilante type things, or somebody has an accident that is doing something wrong, or
I think there are, you know, we could dissect a lot of these numbers, and I think that you know, in some ways, for political retribution and things like that, we certainly do better than a lot of places in the world for now. But I think, from sheer numbers, there's an imbalance, and we'll get into some of the racial components of this as well. Yeah, well, a couple more.
And I bet our numbers don't include the temporary incarceration of the immigrants and things like that.
I'm sure they don't include those. I do believe that they include parole, people who are on parole. But I think you're right. I think they probably don't include that as well. Upstairs, who's up there? Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you.
I don't know exactly, but I think we have an appellate system that
holds people in prison for years and years and years and years without coming to a final solution, like, you know, death penalty or being let go.
In fact, I've got a portion of an interview I'll share with you in a little bit, because I was just down on Texas death row, and Pete Russell has been in the appeals process for 17 years, and he doesn't have another date scheduled to appear in court, even though, you know, there's a case. So I think you're right. I think those things drag on for an awfully long period of time. Yeah, so many good thoughts in the room. Thank you for that. I want to ask you, hang on, what do I have for a picture? I want to ask you to take a look at this phrase, convicted murderer. Think about what comes to mind. Think about what words flow through your mind. And if you feel like sharing it, I'd like to make a little list here. When I say convicted murderer, what do you think?
Scary person.
Yeah, Charles Manson.
Oh, there's only one eye, right? Oh, man. Charles Manson. You're not going to be able to read anything I write anyway. I'll tell you what it says. What else?
It could be anyone.
It could be anyone.
Male.
Oh. Yeah. Male.
Guilty.
Maybe guilty.
Yeah. Maybe guilty.
First through my mind was guilty.
More likely to be black in the South.
More likely to be black and what?
The South.
In the South.
Probably anywhere. Actually, anywhere in the States. Much higher likelihood and being poor.
More likely black and poor.
And
unable to read?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Can I say illiterate?
Sure.
Yeah.
But well, yes.
I'll say unable to read.
Uneducated, kind of
along
the
time.
Miseducated.
Oh, miseducated.
Court provided defense lawyer.
Oh. I'm sorry?
Court provides the defense lawyer rather than going to
public defender. This is a list. Anything else we want to add?
Tragic life.
No access to money to buy your way out.
No access to money.
Mentally ill.
Crimes of passion.
Wounded.
Almost always, yeah.
Hopeless. Feeling without hope.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Where did that come from?
Up here.
Oh, yeah, I'm not doing a good job of looking up at the top. I'm sorry, Tim. Crazy. All right. We're running out of room, but do you remember this, Brenna, when I was going to interview Tyrone Wirtz in Philadelphia? And Tyrone, you're maybe 14. And Tyrone Wirtz, we talked about him a little last night. He was that picture that we had up on the screen. He was convicted of second-degree murder, spent 36 years in prison for that. And I told Brenna I was going to do that interview, and she said, so you're going to go hang out with a murderer? I don't know if any of those words went through your mind when you said that. And I said, yeah, I guess I am. And didn't really know what to expect. But when I came back and I showed her the picture of Tyrone, she said, well, he doesn't look like a murderer. And I thought, well, there you go. Right? What is a murderer supposed to look like? What is a murderer supposed to be like? We hear these statements and our mind fills in all of these blanks that may or may not relate to real life. I have just a couple of minute video of Tyrone. Where's the switch that does just these front lights? Do you know? Back there.
Oh, no, you mean the back ones?
No, the stuff that's fallen on the screen here, these guys.
These guys.
There we go. You're not going to go to sleep, are you?
No.
All right, so I just want to play this quick video.
Okay, my name is Tyrone Works. I was in Greenfield Prison for close to 37 years. I was a life-term prisoner. I wound up getting convicted of second-degree murder, and I was sentenced to a mandatory life without parole sentence. So I was able to file for a conscientious sentence, and former Governor Riddell commuted my sentence on December 14, 2010. I walked out of Greenfield March 14, 2011. For me, you know, my first one in Greenfield, I was young, 23 years old, kind of cocky, arrogant. I was bitter, angry. I was a self-destructive young man. And I'd like to say that there was some acts of compassion that was shown towards me that set me on this road to change my life. And, you know, I went in as one person. Within 6 months, I transformed into the person that my mother, father raised me to be. I went to school and those kind of things. I got involved in a lot of great programs. And so, you know, although I had the life sentence, and what was important to me is that I leave a legacy. Because I had the daughter and I had siblings and stuff like that. And I wanted them to know that although I was in prison, you know, I was a good person.
Joe, can you get those lights again? Thank you. All right, so we'll think about that list. Now, what are some words that come to mind for Tyrone?
Articulate.
Articulate.
Reformed.
Reformed.
Remorseful.
Remorseful.
Family story.
Family story.
Child of God.
Child of God.
Okay. Integrity.
Integrity.
Handsome.
Hey, good looking guy. Now, I don't know who, are there people who weren't here last night or yesterday when I was doing the thing? So I'll tell you that story where we went and photographed Tyrone. That was the house where the murder happened. We got to the end of the interview and tried to decide where we were going to do the picture, and that's where it was. And I've been in touch with Tyrone a little bit since then. I got in touch with him. I was connected with him by a guy named Howard Zaehr, who is known as the grandfather of the restorative justice movement. And when I said, I'm trying to figure out someone I can talk to help understand some of these ideas and some of these things, who can I talk to? And Howard said, oh, you got to connect with Tyrone. So that's what led me there. But I think some of these things are accurate, right? Could be anyone. It was Tyrone, male. He was guilty. Tyrone didn't pull the trigger. Tyrone was in the getaway car. So basically some guys went into an underground club, like in somebody's house where they're dealing cards and they're selling drinks, and they were just going to rob them. They just wanted some money, and it went bad, as these things do. Somebody in the house shot, or one of the people with Tyrone shot someone in the house. They came back to the car. Tyrone drove away. He didn't have great representation because he didn't have resources, and so he wound up thinking, oh, I'm going to plead not guilty because they're not really going to convict me because I didn't really pull the trigger, right? Didn't understand the system and the rule structure enough. He could have pled to a much lesser thing. But because technically he was involved, he was association, life term sentence. So representation, no access to money. You know, money does buy pretty good legal services. Tragic life. He talks about his education. This is really interesting to me. He talks about the fact that when he was in school, he didn't really value education. That his teachers let him know that they thought he was dumb. It's so it didn't matter to him. When he got to prison, you have to do this assessment system, right? And his counselor, Mr. Bello, looked at his tests and he said, well, you know, math was at a fourth grade level and reading was at a third grade level. But Mr. Bello looked at his IQ test and he said, here's the thing, you're really bright. You know, you can do this stuff. And if I, you know, if we can find a process for you to apply yourself, things are going to turn around. And so he started doing that. And he went to school and he got several degrees. He started leading programs. But what's interesting to me is that it was one person who saw a little bit of hope in him. That it was that one person that saw a little bit of promise that allowed him to hold on to that and reform. And move forward. Not everybody gets that one person. Is Eric in here? No. Eric shared a story tonight or today in our studio session, and talking about some of the African American college students that he knew when he was in college, and how every one of them shared a story with him about the number of people that discouraged them and told them they weren't going to be successful for college. He said, I didn't have a story like that to share. But then he said, here's the thing, each and every one of them had one person that said they could do it. You know, and think about that. Sometimes the things that we think are not very big that we share with people can be transformative. I want to ask you to share a few thoughts, and maybe we can just turn and do it with a neighbor for a little bit, and then we can talk a little bit as a big group, but I want you to think about a transformational moment in your life and who made that possible. Maybe someone who saw some promise in you that was able to flip a situation for you. We'll take just 3 or 4 minutes to do that.
Thank you.
Does anybody care to share a story? I'm being diligent about looking up at the top as well as down below, trying to improve myself and my skills every day. Anybody have any? You were just talking about the weekend, weren't you? Cece.
Steve shared that someone, when he went back to, he started as an electrician in his career, but he went back to school to get an associate's degree to maybe do some stuff with like computer science and
electronics.
Mm. One of his professors says, I think you'd be a really good engineer, an electrical engineer, that's what I'm doing. Stay for 2 more years, get that degree, and now he's
he's a research engineer.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. One person.
Yeah.
A little nudge.
Well, that plus my wife paid for it.
All right, two people. It's two people. You're right, it takes a village. Yeah. Good, thank you for sharing that. What else? What else? Yeah.
I think in our group, a very common theme was money and the need for money to, at that time, to get an education and feel like could succeed. And for each one of us, it just took one person to say, yeah, you can do it. There's ways.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, to help you with the resources. Yeah.
Well, in our group, we're all, I mean, probably most of us, we were part of our, the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no money. But yeah, somehow, somebody stood behind us and got us going. But there was no money. So
right.
It all worked out. I don't know, it just unfolded. It's amazing how I don't know where the money came from when they put me in college. I haven't a clue. Someday I'd like to go back, but it was so long ago, I don't think they have records anymore.
We talk about this a lot when we talk about how A Piece of My Mind unfolded, because we started it as we were going broke, and we like to, we were never quite sure if it made sense to go on this path, but we always talk about the manna from heaven that we got. And just when you thought, oh, how are we going to pay the mortgage, there'd be a job that would land in your lap that just happened to be just enough to do it. And
who's we? You're talking about we.
Over there, Karen. Wave, Karen.
Okay.
And Brenna up there. Hello. And their son Jordan, who's not here. Still hasn't ever seen Holden. Silly boy. So I want to share with you something that I heard in the conversation, which was, my husband's a public defender. So let's think a little bit about how that statement up on the board might have felt from that perspective. Because I didn't refute it then, but I should have, that I know some public defenders who do amazing work.
Who work hard.
Who have a heart of gold, who are doing it for all the right reasons.
Could make a lot more money.
Oh. That could make a lot more money going and doing other things, chasing ambulances, whatever. Now there's going to be someone in here who's husband. I stepped in it, didn't I, Joe? Yeah, yeah. No, but I think that's really important to think about. You know, I shared in the last session this story about Bud Welch, whose daughter died in the Oklahoma City bombing, and then he went to work against the execution of Timothy McVeigh. And I shared that story one time out east, and a fella came up to me afterwards and he said, my dad was the guy who pursued the death penalty for Timothy McVeigh. So I had to understand a little bit about how my language came across and how that sat in his experience. You know, I think that's a really important lesson that we all can pay attention to. A lot of times those public defenders are pretty overworked. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got 20 cases on your docket. It's a lot harder to spend the amount of time as somebody who's got one or two on theirs. Mm-hmm. Steve, did you have your hand?
People get these sentences because the population wants these sentences. Mm-hmm. They demand these sentences. So that's why they get meted out, I think. A lot of the judges, I don't think, want to do it. You know, back in Germany, for example, when they used to burn witches,
mm-hmm.
The local magistrates didn't want to burn these witches, but the local people said, look, we don't like this person. We're going to have a riot if you don't get them burned. There's a lot of literature still left over from those times. And it's been happening for a long time.
Interesting. Well, I might go one step beyond that, and I might suggest that there was somebody with a vested interest who wanted to rile up the population to burn the witch.
Well, and that way you got their house and their possessions and whatever.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It's like chasing the Jews out of town. Mm-hmm. And this, stealing all their stuff.
This happened after 9/11, right, as they were trying to round up suspects in Afghanistan. They were giving rewards to local travel people for turning in somebody who was a terrorist. They would give them, you know, the equivalent of 3 to 5 months' salary. And lo and behold, once they started sifting through everybody, they figured out that this guy just had a feud over a goat. You know, he wasn't a terrorist. It wasn't an actual bit of information. You know, so there's some interesting dynamics, I think, that can be going on at times, which kind of leads us into... not Tyrone again. So I've been reading this book, The New Jim Crow. Has anybody read that? Mm-hmm. Yeah? To my understanding, you can read 2 pages and get 3 pages of notes out of it. I mean, it's dense. There's a lot of information in there. And I just want to share a few little bits of information with you that are just from pages 6 through 8 in The New Jim Crow. The U.S. imprisons a larger percentage of its black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. Currently, right now, we do that.
I was still in the midst, but I just want to say this out loud. I have The New Jim Crow, but I've also watched 13th on Netflix, which I say is like the film version of the book. If for folks who aren't able to read 500 pages of the book, in 2 hours you can also watch 13th on Netflix for free.
Oh.
I highly recommend it. It's the same story. The same people who are in the book are also in the film. The author of the book is in the film. I'm saying the same thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. 13th.
Yep, 13th.
All right. Yeah, that's good information. Has anyone else watched that? Yeah? Okay.
It has Bryan Stevenson in it, too.
Yeah, Equal Justice. Justice. Just a couple more stats. In Washington, D.C., 3 out of 4 young black men can expect to serve time. 3 out of 4. I don't have the rest of them typed on things here. This is interesting. When you were talking about drug offenses and using the prison system to control drug offenses, people of all colors, people of all backgrounds, statistically use and sell drugs at similar rates. These numbers don't fluctuate that much. Actually, young white are the most common to be using drugs. In some states, men of color are incarcerated for drugs at 20 to 50 times the rate of white men. Let that sink in a minute. Same level of drug usage, 20 to 50 times the incarceration rate. This speaks to sort of the trends in our country. In between 1960 and 1990, so a 3-decade span, Finland, the United States, and Germany had similar crime rates. Yet during that same time, German incarceration remained stable. Finland dropped by 60%, and the United States quadrupled. So the premise of the book, The New Jim Crow, is that we have historical methods for controlling certain populations in our country. And it was slavery until slavery was no longer acceptable. At which point it became Jim Crow laws in the South and segregation and discrimination like that until Jim Crow became unacceptable. And then it was replaced by the prison system. That there are political terms like law and order, like cracking down on crime, that can be interpreted as code words for racist phrases that you can't say, that they would be called on. So these are ways that politicians could run, and the statistics map them, that the same politicians who supported Jim Crow laws then went on to support tough on crime, three strikes you're out, these sorts of drug laws. And when you look at that and you look at the numbers and how that plays out in our prison system, it's pretty disturbing. Thoughts on that? Again, these are new explorations for me. I mean, they're things that I'm familiar with, but some of these statistics and some of the facts that back it up are a little bit of new territory for me.
I just wanted to add immigration prisons, because that's, did you already speak about that?
No, I mean, that's a whole, we mentioned it briefly, but that's a whole new ballgame that we've got going on.
It's for profit, and they have quotas, and buildings that, this is my understanding of it, buildings that were built for a certain amount of people. But
far exceeded.
Far exceeded, and there's profit. So industries are profiting off of humans.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of system than this system was equally painful.
Problematic. Yeah. Yes.
Well, then it's just perpetuated in the fact that, like, often you lose your right to vote after you've been, like, in certain states, right?
Yeah. It's a perpetual disenfranchisement.
Right. So then, if you lose your political voice,
it's harder to get a job. It's harder to get housing. You are relegated to a permanent underclass, and there's no recourse. Right. There's no way out of that. Yeah. Yes.
It just struck me that the immigration laws and system might be being used to control the Latino and Hispanic population and intimidate them.
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt in my mind. Yeah.
Little lady bed.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, just as far as the statistics about prisons and all, two things to point out. One, there was recently, you know, the crime bill that was passed that Donald Trump supported. And it was a bipartisan crime bill, and they're like loosening up, drug crimes and marijuana crimes and stuff like that too. So the idea is to take a lot of these people out of prison.
Yeah, there are some signs of hope in the system.
And almost every Democratic candidate has a prison reform plan, and, you know, getting rid of for-profit prisons completely, and then even more prison reform to take out even more people, you know, for things like, you know, the kinds of minor drug offenses.
Yeah, nonviolent offenses and things like that.
Yeah, so there is a lot happening on that. I don't know where it's going to go, but...
No, but I think that there is movement in that direction, and there are conversations that are encouraging. I think what happened historically is that the political process started talking about the war on drugs. It got immense amounts of funding. It became politically almost impossible to be against the war on drugs. And actually, when you talk to drug experts, when the war on drugs started, there wasn't a particularly large appetite for the war on drugs. People didn't perceive it to be a big problem. It wasn't leading to violent crime. But it was used as a political tool to ramp up this incredible amount of funding to police departments that would enforce low-level crime. That was low-hanging fruit. It was really easy. And the rhetoric around it talked about using this to get rid of people who were selling and distributing in large amounts. But in fact, the reality is the majority of the convictions were just small possession convictions.
Peggy. I want to take a minute to acknowledge that Joe Davis is the, I think you're the only black person in the room. Is anybody?
I'm not sure.
Anybody
else?
Yeah. Hello? I just want to acknowledge that and say that it must be difficult when you live with these statistics all of your life that you know darn well. And everybody else is going, oh, you're kidding. I mean, it's like, we don't even know our own truth.
Right.
Yeah. So I just want to apologize for all the gasping that's going on, hoping that the room is going to make progress. But I just am so aware of your presence and you knowing this deep in your heart and living with it every day. So I just wanted to
add. You unpack some of these dynamics in the classes that we do.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Florida decided that convicted felons could vote.
Mm-hmm. Is that recent?
Yeah. It was a referendum, and there's been some talk where it's not actually going to be getting implemented because of how the referendum structure works. And the state legislature is actually required to implement the referendums after they get passed.
Interesting.
Lawyer in training.
Then Florida said, yeah, but you've got to clean up all your fines before you can vote, which basically is a poll tax.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
Also, one other thing in the new Jim Crow, with that building up of the war on drugs, as I recall, they were focusing on crack cocaine, which in the black areas.
Not powdered cocaine.
Powdered cocaine, which was like quite rich. And it was kind of a code to go into the black neighborhoods and go after the black, drug users instead of white drug users. And I've also heard, even today, a lot with all the attention on the opioid crisis, like, where was that when crack cocaine was a crisis,
Right. Yeah, there's some inconsistencies in it, which are pretty alarming. Any other thoughts before we move on a little bit? So, where am I here? So I had a chance, again, some of these things are new learning for me, but I was interested in understanding more about the death penalty and did reading, but I was also particularly fascinated in talking to somebody who was on death row, and so that's not something you can just call up Texas Death Row and say, hey, I'd like to come in with my cameras and recording here. It takes a little bit of doing. And I had somebody after one of my talks in Colorado Chautauqua, actually, that came in and said, well, have you ever talked to someone on death row? And I said, well, I'd love to, but I don't really know how to make that work. And he said, I can help you out. And he helped me navigate the process. And so he connected me with the public information officer down in Texas. Trying to remember, I think it's about 217 men on Texas death row. It's in Livingston, Texas. There are 6 women on death row. And as the public information officer said to me, there's women who've done bad things, but juries don't want to put them to death. So I thought that was interesting. But anyway, I had to actually have a formal assignment, letter of assignment from a magazine. So I called one of my magazines that I've worked for in the past, who didn't really have an interest in running this story, but they were interested in writing me a letter of assignment that I could present to the Texas Board of Prisons. And so I had my letter of assignment, presented it to them. You have to provide a list of all of the things that you want to bring into the prison, and then you have to tell them who you want to interview. And I was particularly interested in interviewing somebody who had a date scheduled for their execution, so that it was imminent, so it was present. There were only 4 of those people in the system at the time. Now there are only 3 of them. But from reading the biographies of them, it's hard to get much research on them, but through reading the biographies, none of them had expressed remorse. None of them had accepted responsibility. And I wanted somebody who'd had a little bit more of a transformative process. So I did a little research. I found this guy named Pete Russell, who had murdered his girlfriend. But in prison, he took up yoga and meditation. Actually wrote a book called Death Row Yogi, but accepted responsibility for his crime and was working in whatever ways he could within death row to try to create some positive change. So you have to request a specific inmate. Public information officer brings that to them, and then the inmate gets to choose. And I'll tell you, when I went into the system, I was a little nervous. I was a little uncomfortable. Honestly, mostly of the prison staff. I had preconceptions of what Texas death row prison staff would be. I didn't know if they would like me from up north coming down, poking around, doing this peace thing. But I have to say, they were pretty respectful. It was what was peculiar about the interview was that it wasn't all that peculiar. You know, I was sitting through a plate of glass and talking to Pete. But as they got him ready for this, so I was supposed to get in there and have 30 minutes to be able to set up all of my equipment. I got in there, and 2 minutes later, I turned and Pete was sitting in the little cubicle. I thought, oh no. And I said, can I talk to him? And they said, no, you can't say anything to him. As soon as you start a conversation, your 60-minute clock starts. And it's done. So I'm literally setting up my gear right here, and Pete's sitting right there, and I'm waving at him a little bit, but we can't have any sort of communication. But the public information officer went on the phone and said, Pete, I want to thank you for doing this interview with these guys. I want you to understand that you don't have to answer any questions. You've got full control over the interview. If there's something you don't want to talk about, you're free to say no. If there's anything you need me for during the conversation, let me know and I'll be here for you. And so it was this remarkably human exchange, which sort of encouraged me. I wasn't sure what to expect, but I guess I wasn't expecting that. And there was one other interview going on in the space, only Wednesdays from 1 till 2, do they do interviews with the media. And so there's one other interview going on at the other end of the windows, and so you can hear that a little bit in the audio, but I just want to play a little excerpt from that conversation. Joe, can you hit that one thing again?
Yeah.
Or Cece, or Mike, or everybody? Thank you. All right, so this is Pete. This is the portrait that we wound up doing. So we had a mic pack like this that's clipped onto his uniform right there. We gave it to the guard. The guard brought it around back and handed it to Pete, and then we explained to him how to hook it up. So you can hear a little bit of other sound from the other interview going on, but here's Pete.
Okay, my name is Pete Russell Jr. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. Was in Texas death row here at the Pulaski unit. I was sentenced to death in February 2003.
And you don't have a execution date scheduled?
No, sir.
Okay.
No, sir.
And when does that part happen?
Well, I hope it never happens. You know, as of right now, I'm still in federal court, so my peers are still unfolding. I'm putting it out there that, like I say, an affirmation. I don't think that I will be executed. I think that my case will be overturned, maybe a full reversal, maybe just a punishment phase, and then eventually I will go home. You know, I would have to do some time. You know, I'm not saying that I'm innocent, let me go. You know what I'm saying? That, hey, I did something, and I should be punished for it. But what I did doesn't warrant a death sentence because of my case, legally speaking, 4 years, Texas law, doesn't warrant a death sentence. It carries 2 to 20 years. My case is a crime of passion, a manslaughter case. You know, so yes, I took somebody's life, and again, I should be punished for that according to the law. It's like somebody that's a drunk driver, they run over somebody, they don't send them to death row. You know, because it's a manslaughter. You know, but they do some time for it. You know, they get in trouble for it. And so that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying to excuse what I did. You know, but I don't think that I will be executed. It's what I feel within my heart of hearts.
And when your end comes, regardless of how it happens,
right,
with where you're at in your life now, are you afraid to die?
No, sir. I believe. Spiritually speaking, I believe that death is really a beautiful thing when you understand it. As they say, death is a twin brother of sleep. You know, it's like, think about it, if there was no such thing as a death, just think how this planet would be. You know, the dinosaurs still be here. You'd have Hitler and Stalin and the mosquitoes. Think about all the mosquitoes you try to kill. All the roaches you try to kill. It would just be crazy chaos. If nothing in nature died, it would be chaos on this planet. And so I think death is a beautiful thing. It's just an equalizer, a balance. you know, when your time comes, you know, you have a sign that, you know, like say the scripture, that the angel of death, he'll come get you. You shouldn't be afraid of the angel of death. He just wanted God's service. Hey, man, it's your time. Like you get an email, you get a phone call, it's your time, you know. You can struggle all you want to, but hey, I'm here to get you. And so your name is not in records, it's not your time.
Like I said, I'm still processing this myself. Yeah, thanks, Joe. Because I went straight from that to a busy schedule to Africa to hold it. So it's hard for me to sort of square up what's happening in my head with that. But I'm curious, any thoughts from here on that? Joe?
I was struck by like his resilient spirit, the way he was positively framing death and connected to his spirituality, and even the way he was like, in my heart of hearts, I'm speaking out that I'm not gonna die. Like I accept that I, you know, should have punishment for what I did, but I'm speaking out, I'm not gonna die. Just that resilience in the midst of his circumstances.
I was struck by that as well. He had never done an interview before in the 17 years that he'd been in the system. This was the first time he
couldn't hear it very well. Some of us couldn't hear it very well.
Oh, I'm
what
sorry.
What he's saying, I don't know what he's saying.
Oh, he was... I'll boost it with the mic over here. He was saying that he was amazed by the resilience of Pete Russell, that the fact that he, in the middle of this difficult place, he was still trying to find some sort of positive framing for the situation that he was in and the way he was going to engage. And so it's interesting because in Death Row, in Texas, it's solitary confinement all the time. 23 hours a day you're in your cell, 1 hour a day you're allowed into the courtroom, or at the courtyard, but the courtyard is like dog runs. Is what they call them. And so it will be chain link fence, here's your space, chain link fence, 10 feet of gap, and the next chain link fence, chain link fence. So you can see other people when you're out in that courtyard, but you can't touch them. You have no physical contact at all. So it's 100% isolation. And he talks about the social problems that come from that, you know, the psychological problems that come from that kind of isolation. Any other thoughts? Yes.
How was it for you, and you're still processing, but just kind of putting myself in your place on that side of the glass. How did it feel? What were the feelings that were flowing through you when you looked up and there he was and you're fussing with your equipment? And then
yeah, I mean...
Some pretty pointed questions.
It was a normal 25 words or less, right? It was a normal exchange in that we were having a conversation, and Pete was really open to things, and there was nothing he was uncomfortable talking about. And so the ability to sit with a stranger and ask things about his own mortality is a little unnerving and a little unsettling. How did I feel? I'm not sure yet, other than it felt peculiar, but it felt like a rare space to be in, to sit and have that conversation. Yeah.
Do you feel compelled to make that more public? I mean, I know you are here, but I mean, I know that the magazine didn't want to do the article, but do you feel compelled to write an article to get his information out there?
I want to do more interviews.
Is he looking for an article?
Is what?
Is he looking for an article to happen?
No, he's not looking for an article to happen. Because I told him when I was there that we can't be sure that this will be published.
Okay.
I try to be really clear with all of my subjects. I never know exactly what this is going to be,
right,
but I will try to use it for positive purposes.
Yeah.
My goal is to try to use it to build conversation and awareness. So I don't think I'm going to look for a place to publish this one story, but I want to do more of these and want to have a collection of them. Mm-hmm. We did this in a magazine called Plow Quarterly around immigration, and we pulled out of my book like 6 or 7 different stories with different immigrant perspectives and different immigrant experiences. And for me, my bodies of work, I tend to think, are more powerful in community and collection than any one particular story. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect I'll wait. The studio process that we did here, I'm going to be doing with life-term prisoners in Minnesota in the next couple of months, asking them questions about what they aspire to, what do they still dream of. And then I want to do a couple more interviews around this before I feel like I have a body of work, before I feel like, right now I guess I'm kind of in exploration mode. I think there's something interesting to tap into there. I don't think I'm there yet, and I need more time engaging with these stories before I feel like I have something that I want to push up. That being said, this whole interview is on my website, A Piece of My Mind, that clip, another clip, plus a 20-minute audio clip, which includes most, you know, a good chunk of the interview. Yeah.
I think one thing that I noticed that I think we are really good at forgetting, he said, I did something wrong, I should be punished, but not to this extent. I think it's so easy as someone in the general public that doesn't have a strong connection to the criminal justice system to say, oh, they just want a lesser sentence because they don't want to deal with it.
They don't want to take responsibility for their crime.
They don't think this, they don't think that, they, but that's not at all what
he's, what he's saying, asking
you know,
for.
He's asking for the same thing that any other person would ask for, or how the system should be treating them as well.
Yeah.
Did he ask you any questions?
He asked me what I did that day. You know, and we talked about the drive down there a little bit. And then I asked him what he did while he was waiting for us. And he said, well, today would, so the morning on Wednesdays is visitation day for families, and the afternoon is for the media interviews. So he said, well, when I woke up, he said I could hear the families and the children coming. He said, so I looked out of my window and I could see the kids walking and I could see a bird flying by. And then I did some meditation and then I did some reading and then I had a cup of coffee and then I waited on you, is what he said. Yeah.
Did he have any family visit him ever? Or did he
say? We didn't get to that. No, I wish I would have. You know, it's pretty hard. 60 minutes with a person from the time you sit down. And I was in the structure of that 60 minutes, I said to him at the beginning, Pete, what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is we're going to sit down and I've got a list of questions and we'll have a conversation for the first 40 minutes. And I said, then I'm a little uncomfortable with my time limitations and I want to make sure we get the picture. So we'll break it 40 minutes, we'll do some photos, and then if we have some time left over, we'll continue the conversation. And we went right up to 59 minutes and 50 seconds. And then our helper from the prison service was right here over my shoulder and we had to say goodbye. So it was a pretty tight ship. Anything else on that one? Yeah.
A little bit of a strange question, but you selected him because he accepted responsibility for his crime. I wonder what your interview would have been with someone who didn't, one of the other four.
Yeah, I wonder that too. And honestly, maybe I'll have the courage for an interview like that at some point. I wanted to, the stories in A Piece of My Mind that I'm the most interested in are stories of transformation. Stories of people who found themselves in difficult places and have found a way to create positive change in that situation. And I wanted that to be reflected in this story too. You know, people always ask me the question, you know, or for A Piece of My Mind, are you going to interview someone who's a neo-Nazi? Are you going to interview somebody who's a white supremacist? And I'm not ready for that. I think there's a personal toll that's exacted. I'm not sure that I would know how to navigate that conversation with someone who is unwilling to acknowledge the value of others. And so someday maybe that'll happen, but I'm also worried about giving people like that a platform. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so interested. Somebody said once, when you're planting a garden, you don't want to sow weeds intentionally. You know, so if I'm trying to work on a project that looks for ways to build connections, that's a pretty tough one to swallow for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that would be interesting at some point. There's one more little video of him, one little clip that I'll play quick, around a different little thread that we followed. Starts out by saying,
my name is Pete Russell Jr. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. Was in Texas death row at the Pulaski unit.
I like to ask everybody, when I say the word peace, what does that mean to you?
Peace to me means, for an acronym, it means please educate all children with equality.
In your situation on death row, with the difficulties that might be around you, where have you seen examples of peace happen there?
You have to protect your peace back here. And a lot of times, you know, if an officer is open, I will pull an officer up and tell them basically how to maintain their peace. You know, let them know, look, man, you don't have to get mad, because at the end of the day, you can go home to your family, to your kids and stuff. A peace of mind, you know, it's like something, like I say, valuable. You know, like jewelry, you know, it's valuable. It's way more, the peace is way more valuable than jewelry, you know, because you don't want somebody to steal your peace. Because if somebody steal your peace, you be messed up. It's like back here on death row. When I'm in my cell, you know, like I'm a real humanist person, I read books, I listen to the radio, and I may talk to my neighbor if they talk. But a lot of times I meditate, I chant, I do everything to tune up, to maintain peace of mind. I don't let nothing get on my nerves or rattle my peace.
What do you think you know now that you didn't know before? What is the biggest lesson that you think you've found?
To answer that question, I would say that God living in man. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that God living in man, you know, in the form of your higher self, in the form of spirit. And again, it's not nothing that I read. This is what I experienced. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that God lives within me, and I can commune with God anytime I want to through meditation.
So I'm curious, when you talk about what you've learned, is there any way you could have learned this outside of the path that you've traveled, do you think?
What I learned today, I couldn't have learned it at home, in the streets, or in prison the first time. And so, like I say, this is part of the karma. I had to come here, you know, and learn this. That's why, like I say, when you really look at it, there's nothing wrong with going to hell. You say, you're going to go to hell. You think about hell, you think about the fire. We know the fire purifies. The sun is on fire right now, and it gives us life. You know, so we don't have a problem with the fire. Coming to death row, this is like the ultimate hell, if you will. Like, hey, man, they're going to kill you. You know, electrocute you, or chop your head off, or whatever. And so coming here, I learned about life, I learned about spiritual life, and this is why I can say, as I look back, I couldn't have learned what I learned now in the streets or with my mother.
Couldn't have learned these lessons anywhere else but where he was then. Oh, we'll wait on that.
Good question.
Yeah.
What was he told about you and the interview beforehand?
I wrote a brief letter of introduction. That's the only thing he knew about me. He doesn't have access to the internet. You know, and I said, I've got this project. I did mail him one of my books. I think I mailed in both of my books. And I said, hey, I'm looking to do an interview about this. And I framed it because this is something I'm working on now, a collection of stories that reckon with end of life. And, you know, one perspective, a very different perspective, is someone who's on death row. So that's really all he knew. I told him just a brief history of the project. I said, you know, what I'm just interested in sitting down for a conversation. Someday this could be part of a collection that I would share online in a book or in an exhibit, and the goal is to start conversations. That's really all he knew about me coming in. Yeah.
How old was he when he committed the crime?
24, something like that. So just background on this. So he was in prison earlier, 7 years for drugs, did his time, came out. His girlfriend set him up, and he did another drug deal. His girlfriend set him up, so that was with an undercover cop. He got tried, sentenced. They gave him a short period of time to go out and get his affairs in order, and the official record says that he beat her to death with a hammer, and then was convicted of the life sentence there.
So in my lifetime, it seems like the juvenile justice system is eroded considerably. When I was a kid, you know, you were protected by those laws until you were 21.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's 18. And
and there are a number of people who are tried.
And they keep eroding those laws. And they try to do more in the juvenile justice system to rehabilitate these people and educate these people. But, you know, the kids don't have a chance. And I know those laws, I'm sure, don't apply equally to white kids and kids of color and white kids, but it's a tragedy in our society to let that happen.
Yeah. If you couldn't hear, he's just saying that the juvenile justice system in particular has eroded over the years, and that we continue to charge younger and younger people as adults in the process. I think, Peg, one of the reasons I'm not ready to share this to a broader audience yet is that there are some facts and details of the case that I'm not sure I understand fully, that I haven't researched completely. And if I was gonna share it really publicly, I would wanna have some more of those facts down. To be honest, they don't matter to me. The specifics of that case don't matter to me as much as recognizing some humanity in Pete. But I understand if it's gonna be in a bigger public forum, I need to grapple with those a little bit.
Makes sense.
So his premise is, so the state's premise is that his was premeditated, that he went back to his girlfriend to kill her. His premise is that he went back to visit her to try some sort of reconciliation. There was some jealousy, crime of passion, and he killed her. That's the difference between manslaughter and capital life. So that is a part of his appeals process. Do I know the facts of which is true? No. Does that matter fundamentally to me in having a real conversation, a full conversation with him? Not really. So, was there another hand? Yeah.
Well, I thought his acronym was really intriguing, and I don't know a lot about the criminal justice system, but relatives or other people who, I mean, sometimes, a lot of times they had trouble in a learning disability or something, or like the
Tyrone,
yeah, that they just were underachieving all those years in school, and they're functionally illiterate as young adults, and go figure, they're angry, and I wonder if he had more to that from talking to his neighbors there, if he thought that was a common problem, that the poor education was part of what led him on the one path and as opposed to his new path.
Yeah, it would be interesting to do some of those statistics and try to understand some of that.
So mitigating circumstances, what was the picture, portrait of his life?
Yeah, and
he alluded to his mother, and I would love to know the mitigating circumstances.
Yeah, and if you listen to the 20-minute interview online, the audio, there's some more information. We didn't go in depth into his background, but there is some of that. To explore. I want to share, boy, we're running out of time. I want to share one more story with you. And this one hasn't even been edited yet. This one I don't have any video to show, but I want to tell you a little bit about it. Oops, sorry, Pete. So this is Michelle Lyons. who used to work, this is kind of the other side of the equation, right? She used to work for the Department of Corrections, and her job was, she used to be public information officer, and as a part of that, part of her job is to usher the media in to witness executions, usher family members in to witness executions. In her lifetime, she has witnessed almost 300 executions in the state of Texas, in Huntsville, in the chamber, where they are. And so, she's written a book. I saw an article. This is how the project works. I saw an article in the BBC about this woman like a year ago, and I'm like, whoa, I can't even imagine what that would be like, what that does internally to you when you expose yourself to that kind of situation so often. When I was going down, I had Pete's interview scheduled, and when I was going down there, I'm looking at my schedule, and I'm like, you know, if I don't sleep at all, there's a chance that I can do one more interview. And wouldn't that be interesting? And so I've never done this before in my life. I looked up Michelle's info. Oh, dear. Long goodbye. Sorry, squirrel. Sorry. I couldn't find her contact info. I couldn't find the real like phone number, email, anything. But I found her Twitter, and I tweeted at her. I've never tweeted at anybody in my life. I said, hey, I'm going to be down in your area. Would love to set up a interview if you're doing media interviews. Boom. Right back. I'd love to. What time are you thinking? I'm like, well, what are the odds she's going to be available during the tiny little window? I think she was. She's like, come on over. So we had this conversation, which was really fascinating. Again, this is a circumstance like Tyrone, where we got to the end, and I said, we met at a bar, too noisy, so we went across the street to a little gazebo in a park to do the interview, and we got done, and I said, that this doesn't have any context to me. To photograph someone who's witnessed 300 executions in a park didn't really sit. And I said, what else can we think about? And she said, well, there's the cemetery down the way. And I said, what cemetery is that? And she said, well, when a prisoner dies and nobody comes and claims the remains, the state has a cemetery where they bury them. And I'd actually read about that in her book, but I thought, in my understanding, it was inside the prison walls and there's no way we'd have access, but it's just like down the road. It's in town. So this is actually the cemetery where unclaimed remains of prisoners go. So we did that there. Hang on, I had a couple of notes of what I wanted to share. So it was an interesting conversation, and I think Michelle and I probably differ on a lot of things politically and process-wise. And I said, well, why does, I mean, Texas does half of the executions that happen in our country, really. And I said, why does Texas have so many executions? And she said, well, because people do a lot of bad stuff here. We don't have a choice. I thought, I don't know. I think we always have a choice. Right? And when I start having that conversation, oh man, 7 minutes. When I start having that conversation, I start asking questions like, well, is this effective? Is it actually doing what we intend for it to do? Is it cost effective? Does it make sense to keep someone locked up that long? Does it impact crime? Does it allow the ability for redemption in any way? You know, these are some of the questions I'm asking myself. What are some of the questions you ask yourself around these issues?
I've always often wondered, the family members of the victims will go, mm-hmm. and sometimes I can't have closure till then, and I just have a hard time processing that. That would be interesting to hear afterwards if that really did close everything up, if they were, oh, okay, now I can move on. But to keep your life on hold for all those years.
Waiting for that moment. Well, I'll tell you, Michelle explained to me that in the death chamber itself, it's a small little place, and there's a partition between the family members of the victims and the family members of the inmate. And so if they're laying this way and this is their head, and this is their feet. The partition runs here, and the family members of the inmate are down here, so that as they're laying down, they can look directly at them. They have to be intentional about looking to the side to see the family of the victim. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, Michelle said that she left her job and she quit doing this when she became a mother. And when she would bring the mother of the inmate in to the thing, she said there is a physical barrier, but you can hear the sound on both sides. She said she could no longer tolerate, when she was a mother, hearing the mother of the inmate mourning at the loss of their son.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
She used to witness them from the inmate's side. She said she had to disassociate herself and go to the other side, so she was on the victim's side, but even then, she could still hear the mother, mm-hmm. and she couldn't bear it any longer. Yes?
You said her son. So are there any females on death row?
There are 6 females on Texas death row. I don't believe any of them have been executed for a very long time. So it's almost universally the males that are executed.
What's the means of execution in Texas?
Injection.
Okay.
She also said that one of the most disturbing things to her was to watch the inmate get up on the table with almost no resistance. When they bring him into the room, he's not handcuffed. And he walks up, he steps on the stool, he lays down and does this. Almost always. I don't know what that says about our process or about us.
I can't help but think about, being a Christian, thinking about Jesus. And then also thinking about Mary, and experiencing that.
Witnessing.
And all the different, and how real that makes, just connecting the two.
Yeah, I appreciate that connection.
Thank you. Jesus.
Isn't it a fact that it is less expensive to keep the person imprisoned as opposed to proceed with the execution?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's more expensive to do the death penalty.
And I think it's because primarily of all of the appeals processes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, not the cost of the actual physical act of the execution, right. But the cost of all of the appeals that happen in the process. Yeah.
If this is a subject that interests people, there's a book called Just Mercy.
That is Brian Stevenson, right?
Brian Stevenson. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but I've heard.
And we'll give you a new look.
Yeah. They're hard conversations, they're important conversations. I think if we live in a country that sanctions this kind of activity, if we participate in a system that sanctions this kind of activity, we have to accept responsibility for it. And if it doesn't sit right, it's our obligation to change that. Tomorrow morning, we're just talking about going to Africa. It's going to be much lighter. I'm going to be, my 10:30 session is about this trip to Nairobi, Kenya that I just did, and we'll share some of the photos and some of the stories that we gathered there around what inspires you to do good in the world. What inspires you to do good in the world. So, thank you for your time.